Hello, I'm Mike Eastland. Welcome to Cross Currents, a weekly reading of local editorials and opinion pieces. As a reminder, all the views expressed are those of the writers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Chris Radio or its staff. Now let's turn first to the editorial and opinion pages of the Hartford Current from the July 10th edition. This first piece, written by Stephen Delco, entitled A Threat to Democracy and the Rule of Law. The recent decision by the Roberts Court to grant former President Donald Trump immunity on official acts has raised serious concerns about the future of democracy in the United States. This decision has far-reaching implications that could potentially undermine the rule of law and the principles of accountability that are fundamental to our democracy. One of the most significant implications of this decision is the lack of accountability it provides to the executive branch. Without the possibility of legal recourse, the president and other government officials are free to act with impunity, knowing that they will not be held responsible for their actions. This could lead to a culture of corruption and abuse of power, where the ends justify the means and the rule of law is ignored. It would not be difficult for a president like Trump to accuse a whistleblower of treason and thereby making it an official act to have them arrested, which could nullify their legal protection as a whistleblower, making it impossible for those who report fraud, waste, or abuse of power to seek justice. This could lead to a culture of silence and fear where individuals are reluctant to speak out against the government. Furthermore, the decision effectively grants the president and other government officials immunity for any actions taken against citizens, including violations of their civil rights. This could lead to a surge in police brutality, voter suppression, and discrimination, as government officials directed by the president could possibly no longer be held accountable for their actions. The president could potentially break laws such as the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the Americans with Disabilities Act without consequence. The ruling also has significant implications for environmental and public health protections. The president and other government officials can now gut environmental and public health regulations without consequence, leading to a surge in pollution, toxic waste, and public health crises. The president could potentially break laws such as the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act without consequence. Additionally, the decision could lead to a culture of corruption and self-dealing, as the president and other government officials could now accept bribes and engage in corrupt activities without consequence. This could lead to a surge in emoluments violations as government officials use their positions for personal gain. The president could potentially break laws such as the Bribery Act, the Conflict of Interest Act, and the Ethics in Government Act without consequence. The Chevron decision recently by the Supreme Court has added insult to injury by taking away discretion of important regulatory agencies' rules, putting them in the hands of Trump's appointed judges that might undermine environmental, food and drug, and other important regulations that protect Americans. In a major ruling in the Chevron case, the Supreme Court cut back sharply on the power of federal agencies to interpret the laws that they administer and ruled that courts should rely on their own interpretation of ambiguous laws best understood by the agencies and not the courts. The decision will likely have far-reaching effects across the country from environmental regulation to health care costs. The impact on immigration and border control is also concerning. The rule could allow the president and other government officials to engage in cruel and inhumane treatment of immigrants and asylum seekers without consequence, leading to a surge in human rights violations. The president could potentially break laws such as the Immigration and Nationality Act, the Refugee Act, and the Convention Against Torture without consequence. Additionally, the Trump immunity decision could lead to a culture of corruption and self-dealing, as the president and other government officials could now accept bribes and engage in corrupt activities without consequence. This could lead to a surge in emoluments violations as government officials use their positions for personal gain. The president could potentially break laws such as the Bribery Act, the Conflict of Interest Act, and the Ethics in Government Act without consequence. Trump has already allegedly tried to bribe the president of Ukraine by withholding military aid for their help in finding dirt on Joe Biden. Furthermore, the decision could have significant implications for national security. The president and other government officials could engage in reckless and dangerous behavior without consequence, leading to a surge in national security risks. The president could potentially break laws such as the National Security Act, the Espionage Act, and the War Powers Resolution without consequence. In conclusion, the recent court decision granting former President Donald Trump immunity on official acts is a threat to democracy and the rule of law. It could lead to a lack of accountability, a shift in the balance of power, and a chilling effect on the ability of individuals to seek justice. The implications are far-reaching and could have devastating consequences for the American people. We urge the legal community and all citizens who care about democracy to speak out against this decision and to work towards a future where accountability and the rule of law are upheld. Another op-ed from the Hartford Current, this one dated July 8th, is written by Tiana Hercules. Blocking legal Connecticut cannabis businesses, a devastating blow to entrepreneurs. Legal cannabis is good for Connecticut. Our state collected over $22 million in tax revenue just in the first year of adult use legalization, with much of this revenue being invested in communities that were disproportionately harmed by cannabis prohibition. Teen cannabis use is down in states with legal cannabis, and some research even shows that being near a dispensary can raise property values. That's why most Connecticut residents support cannabis legalization. Despite the overwhelming data that concludes the positive impact of cannabis, a stigma remains, producing a local pushback from some of the same people who generally support cannabis. Whether it's cannabis legalization, affordable housing, public transportation, or some other social good, a phenomenon emerges where the same people who support the general concept become skittish when something comes to their neighborhood or backyard. This is commonly known as NIMBYism. NIMBYism around cannabis is popping up and is actively undermining the sustainable, job-creating industry many of us are trying to build. Throughout our state, town after town is voting to prohibit cannabis sales or hijacking zoning processes to prevent cannabis dispensaries from opening. This short-sighted decision actively stifles economic development while not achieving its presumed goal, keeping cannabis out of your backyard. Connecticut is a small state. If one town bans a recreational cannabis dispensary, adults can legally purchase cannabis products just a short distance away or simply purchase from the non-tested or age-gated illicit market. Instead of inhibiting cannabis consumption, prohibiting cannabis businesses denies the local community necessary infrastructure updates from a 3% sales tax dedicated to the city or town where the sale occurs and limits a town's ability to keep cannabis out of the hands of minors by strengthening the illicit industry. Sales made at legal dispensaries are strictly age-gated to adults 21 and older. Legal cannabis businesses frequently give back to their communities in comparison to other retail establishments, directly writing checks to support local charities while spearheading other activities in support of social good. As a black female entrepreneur with a background in criminal justice and public good, I have personally spearheaded dozens of expungent clinics to help individuals clear their criminal records. This is in addition to the organic ways dispensaries contribute to local communities and economies, such as bringing new foot traffic into other local businesses in downtown areas. Blocking legal cannabis businesses delivers a devastating blow to entrepreneurs trying to start up a business in one of the country's most regulated industries, specifically female entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs of color. Limiting the number of towns where a dispensary can be located, combined with additional necessary restrictions such as the proximity to a school or church, significantly restricts the real estate that fits all operational requirements. Ultimately, this drives up the startup costs associated with opening a dispensary and makes it harder for demographics with historically less access to capital to own and run a cannabis business. Working in legal cannabis is not for the faint of heart, and I knew this wouldn't be an easy journey, but I didn't expect to be held back by the same people who would benefit most from embracing local legal cannabis. I hope that my fellow Connecticut residents soon see how their neighboring communities are thriving with cannabis businesses, look at the facts, and reconsider their approach to legal cannabis sales in their towns. The author, Tiana Hercules, is a Hartford City Council member and licensed cannabis operator. Moving on to the pages of the Waterbury Republican-American and their July 7th editorial entitled, "The Mythical Average Persists." The mythical average for government employee compensation persists in Connecticut, and taxpayers continue to groan under the weight of the costs associated with this deeply defective approach to the provision of public services. The long-running myth holds that city, town, and state elected officials are obligated to ensure that their employees receive, at a minimum, the average levels of pay and benefits. They accomplish this by comparing their compensation levels with those in other similar municipalities. The trouble is, the average is always beyond reach. That's because every time one jurisdiction gives raises to its workers to attain average pay and benefit scales, workers in other jurisdictions fall below the average. One municipal leader buying into the average compensation myth recently is Plymouth Mayor Joseph Kilduff. June 25th, he explained a big jump in pay scales for some workers, June 25th ranging from 6.8% to 14.5%, by saying, "We were on the very low end of the pay rate for public works, so this is a way to try to rectify that." At least until other municipalities respond to Plymouth's magnanimity in the usual way. This sort of thing has been going on for many years. Public employees receive total compensation packages that are 25% to 46% higher than private employees with comparable skills and experience, the Hartford-based Yankee Institute for Public Policy found in its landmark 2015 study, entitled "Unequal Pay: Public versus Private Sector Compensation in Connecticut." In a 2020 follow-up study, Andrew G. Biggs found the median Connecticut state or local government employee receives total compensation that is approximately 28% higher than is paid to comparable private sector workers. So, not only are municipal and state officials chasing an average that is constantly in an upward trajectory, but they're constantly widening the disparity between public sector and private sector compensation. As we noted in a 2015 editorial, school boards and other elected officials, terrified of alienating big public labor, engage in an annual quest for a mythical average pay scale, a quest that always pushes salaries upwards, regardless of taxpayers' ability to keep feeding the beast. Waterbury, however, had been operating under the management prerogatives of a powerful state oversight board, which was focused entirely on engineering Waterbury's fiscal recovery. This resulted in disparities often reaching $20,000 between pay scales for Waterbury teachers and for teachers in other public school systems. If every city and town had been provided with an oversight board, or remarkably courageous elected officials, during that same period, the vast salary disparity simply wouldn't exist, the 2015 editorial continued. Teachers would be less motivated to jump to neighboring districts, and taxpayers, whether in Waterbury or Woolcott or Cheshire, would be better off for it. During the too brief reign of the Waterbury Oversight Board, elected officials in other municipalities were sometimes heard to express the wish that they could have oversight boards too. That's one wish that is unlikely to be granted anytime soon, but it's not too late for a few remarkably courageous elected officials to start pushing back against the unsustainable trend in municipal and state employee compensation. Time now for our weekly visit with columnist Chris Powell and his July 8th column from his website, chrispowellcolumn.com, entitled "Mansions Don't Foil Housing and Taxing Them Won't Build It." Apparently, you don't have to do much thinking to run a think tank in Washington, or at least not a liberal think tank. The Connecticut Mirror reports that two such think tanks, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, have produced a study concluding that Connecticut could raise tens of millions of dollars every year to spend on reducing homelessness or spend on something else by imposing an extra conveyance tax on the state's most expensive homes. Well, duh. Connecticut could get that kind of money by raising taxes or imposing new ones on nearly anything, not just property transfers. What is the connection between Connecticut's desperate shortage of housing and its most expensive homes? There isn't one. The mansions of mansion tax proposals aren't why the state is short of housing and why housing prices have been rising so fast. While mansions typically occupy larger lots, Connecticut remains full of vacant land and, especially in its cities, decrepit former industrial and residential sites. The state has plenty of room for more housing. Land hogging by the wealthy is not getting in the way. Connecticut's housing shortage has four major causes. First is the soaring inflation of the last few years, engineered by President Biden and Congress. This has driven up prices and mortgage rates far faster than the incomes of ordinary people. People who own residential and other substantial property, especially the wealthy, profit from inflation, but most others suffer from it. Another cause is the flood of illegal immigration, a matter of Democratic Party policy on both the federal and state levels. It may be no coincidence that the number of illegal immigrants estimated to be living in Connecticut, more than 100,000, is close to the number of housing units the state is said to lack. A cause of longer duration is exclusive zoning in suburbs and rural towns, zoning that discriminates against less expensive housing, particularly apartments and condominiums. Such zoning generally has community support, since most people don't want their neighborhoods to become more crowded, though, of course, their own arrival may have increased the neighborhood's population. Exclusive zoning has its own cause. In some places, exclusive zoning arose long ago from racism or ethnic or religious bigotry. But for many years now, exclusive zoning has been sustained mainly by fear of poor people generally, a fear largely justified by the disaster inflicted on the cities, their residents, and everyone else by mistaken state and federal welfare and education policies. People don't want the pathologies of poverty, fatherlessness, child neglect, crime, ignorance, indolence, and dependence imported into their neighborhoods by new housing accessible to the poor. This fear has produced zoning and community opposition that now often obstruct even middle-class owner-occupied housing. State government has responded with a law that weakens the use of exclusive zoning against housing, but it hasn't been very effective, and in any case, inflation, declining real wages, and illegal immigration still stand in the way. That's why that Washington think tank study on raising taxes on the sale of mansions and a similar proposal by State Senate President Martin Looney, a Democrat from New Haven, to impose a punitive statewide property tax on mansions are so dishonest. While these ideas will raise money, there's no guarantee that much of it will be spent to build housing. More likely, the money will be used, as most tax revenue in Connecticut is used, to pay the compensation of government's own employees, the Democrat Party's campaign army, while punitive taxes on mansions provide camouflage for the real objective. Housing supply can be increased without punitive taxes on large homes by stopping inflation, enforcing immigration law, having state government cover all extra school and police costs of new housing, and revoking the welfare and education policies that manufacture poverty. But that would take the fun out of blaming mansions for the declining living standards caused by elected officials who style themselves defenders of the poor, even as they make poverty worse. Next up, from the Wilton Bulletin, this July 10th column is written by Stephen Hudspeth, who had been a regular contributor to the Wilton Bulletin, now an occasional columnist, with his column entitled, "Wilton Schools, Not Connecticut, Should Decide How Students Learn to Read." Now that the budget as proposed by our town boards has been approved by town vote, it's a good time to turn our attention to dealing with the state-imposed requirement for significant changes in our reading education program. The payment by the Wilton School District, by state direction, for this purpose involves out-of-pocket costs in excess of $300,000 for the purchase of the required materials, though with a third of that amount provided by the state itself. Those out-of-pocket costs do not include the implicit but very real cost to Wilton of teacher training in the new materials and disruption in existing education programs. We've seen how tight this coming year's school budget is, and to have imposed on top of that tightness this additional expense is really unfortunate. We've also seen how hard the Board of Education and School Superintendent Kevin Smith and his school administrators have worked to make this budget so lean, but still as effective as possible within those financial constraints. They've done that already before the cut in the Board of Education's proposed budget by an additional $300,000 was made by Board of Finance directive as part of the final step before presentation to the full town budget to the annual meeting. The irony is, of course, that that final required reduction turned out to closely match the out-of-pocket costs of this new state-imposed program. The double irony of this new program's imposition is that it's so obviously unnecessary given the results our Wilton schools have been obtaining over multiple years now in reading education. Those results place our Wilton School District at the top of all performance results for schools throughout our state in reading education. This success is reflected in the extent to which our Wilton students have not just come to do reading so effectively, but also actually to really enjoy reading and to choose to do more of it on their own. The new requirement has been imposed as part of a state initiative, apparently directed at creating uniformity of materials and teaching methods for reading across all school districts in the state. The model being employed by the state for this purpose, something called the Science of Reading, has a nice sounding name, but in reality seems largely to regurgitate techniques that were in use in the 1970s. Those techniques involve the teacher placing herself in front of the entire class and proceeding to instruct all of the students together at the same pace and in the same way. Since that time, a half century ago, new instructional techniques in reading have developed and been implemented very successfully, and especially so here in Wilton as those documented performance results reflect. Those techniques often involve students working together in small groups and are much more individually focused. Our school district has sought a waiver of this new requirement from both the state with a detailed written submission that includes a full description of the success of Wilton's existing reading program, something that should have been well known to state education authorities in any event, of course. However, that waiver request was denied by the state's Commissioner of Education. Especially at a time of such school budget tightness here in Wilton, both now and repeatedly over the past decade, that has put us at the very bottom of the percentage increases among school districts in the region, we don't have the luxury of spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on unnecessary materials and programs. In light of this, the question comes to mind as to why our elected state political leaders from this region have not been able successfully to put pressure on Governor Lamont to get Wilton that waiver from this unnecessary and wasteful state requirement. The state's Commissioner of Education is a Lamont appointee, and Lamont therefore presumably has the authority to govern the commissioner's conduct. The Wilton school budget manages its resources very well and has done so under really tight budget constraints by everyone's admission, especially over the past decade. Unnecessary spending that offers no realistic prospect of better results than the excellent ones we already have, and in fact, the possibility of diminishment in those results through the application of this science of reading methodology is very disheartening. It is certainly counterproductive to the objective that should be foremost in the mind of our state, as it certainly is in the minds of our district, to provide the best quality education within our power to our students. The author, Stephen Hudspeth, is an over 35-year resident of Wilton, active in local matters, and as I mentioned earlier, used to have a regular column in the Wilton Bulletin. Only have a few minutes left. Going to try to squeeze in two more short ones. This one, another one from the Wilton Bulletin, dated July 10th, as written by Zach Olson, entitled, A Connecticut Farmer's Perspective on Dairy Farming, It's a Way of Life. It's a time to celebrate and recognize the hard work and dedication of dairy farmers across the country. My journey in agriculture began in my hometown of South Windsor, where I started milking cows for a local farmer at age 15. That job ignited my passion for agriculture and dairy farming. After high school, I pursued my interests further, studying at the University of Wisconsin before earning my degree in animal science from UConn. While there, I met the Paraccio family of Highton Farm in Coventry, where I have worked for nearly 20 years. My role at Highton Farm has evolved over the years. I started milking and feeding cows, but today I serve as the operations manager, overseeing all the daily farm operations, primarily focusing on crop work. What I truly appreciate about dairy farming is its cyclical nature. We grow crops to feed the cows and then use cow manure to nourish the next crop. Recently, our farm has taken a significant step to further our sustainability practices by adding an anaerobic digester. This technology allows us to transform manure and food waste into a more valuable product which is used for fertilizer, cow bedding, and more, all while generating electricity to help power up to 400 homes. We are incredibly proud of this innovation as it demonstrates our commitment to renewable energy and environmental stewardship. Animal care is also paramount to dairy farmers. Our cows are how we make a living, so treating them with the highest standard of care only makes sense. Healthy cows are productive, and their well-being directly impacts the quality of their milk. That's why we ensure they receive the best care possible, from proper nutrition to comfortable living conditions. Trust in your local dairy farmers is crucial. Our dedication to milk quality and safety is personal. We live it every day. We live near our farms and consume what we produce. At the end of the day, dairy farmers are just like everyone else. We are parents who feed our children the same dairy products found in the grocery stores. These products are safe and nutritious, and we take great pride in ensuring their quality. Dairy farming is more than a job. It's a way of life. It involves hard work, long hours, and a deep connection to the land and our animals. But there's flexibility, a sense of purpose, and great satisfaction in dairy farming. I invite you to appreciate dairy farmers' dedication and hard work. We are committed to providing you with the best products while embracing sustainable practices to protect our environment for future generations. The author, Zach Olson, is the operations manager at Highton Farm in Coventry. The farm milks 350 cows and is a member of the AgriMark Dairy Cooperative. And finally, back to the Waterbury Republican-American, and this, I believe it's a letter to the editor entitled, Connecticut Needs to Ensure Only Eligible Voters Are Allowed to Vote, this dated July 9th. I won't have time to read the entire thing. Seeing the Bridgeport debacle related to election crime unfold in the newspapers concerns me as a voter. I feel that my civil rights are being violated because of the election fraud that is being revealed. The fraud in Bridgeport doesn't just affect voters in Bridgeport. It affects every single voter in this state. Both Republican and Democratic parties in Connecticut refuse to do their constitutional duties and follow both federal and state law. Americans are hacked daily. Computer crime is at an all-time high. It's quite simple. We don't know who the voters are because of our inaccurate voter rolls that are outsourced to a private company named the Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC. ERIC is an electronic database. ERIC is immune from FOIA requests because it is a private company. We do not know if the ballots entering the system are legitimate. We do not know if the ballots that got submitted at the polling place or through the mail or in ballot boxes were counted. The method of counting, tabulators, is untested, unproven, but probably insecure. This is because Connecticut does not have certification or audit records for the election management system, tabulators, per the Secretary of the State's Council FOIA testimony, dated June 23, 2023, with audio of FOIA hearing in D'Alessio versus SOS. At the end of the day, we must be able to prove through independent, trusted parties that the law was followed and elections are valid by following a detailed process that is transparent, auditable, and according to both federal and state law. And that's all we have time for in today's edition of Cross Currents. I did have to cut that one short. I've been reading from the pages of the Hartford Current, the Waterbury Republican-American, ChrisPowellColumn.com, and the Wilton Bulletin. I'm Mike Eastland. So long until next time.